Welcome to the Brothers Karamazov and Friends, an audiobook disguised as a podcast. Each week we explore the endless pile of pages that comprise the greatest novel of all time, The Brothers Karamazov. We have three rules on TBKAF, and only three. Rule number one, there are no redos. Rule number two, you will receive no help with pronunciation. And rule number three, you have to do voices for the characters. All of them. We'll read each week for exactly 1 hour and pick up the next week where we left off. We're joined this week by Bryson Kearns, son of Stu and Kelly Kearns, and servant of No Man. Bryson once built a trebuchet with his bare hands, and we trust that his knowledge of antiquated war machines will enrich our reading tonight. Good evening, Bryson.
Good evening, Bill.
We are very excited to have you here on the show.
Podcast. Excited to audiobook,
whatever you would like to call it. Would you like to tell us a little bit about this trebuchet that you built one time?
It was a long time ago, you know, I'm beginning to suspect that perhaps
you did not actually build this trebuchet.
Well, I did. I did.
Okay.
I don't know how you know about it.
The internet.
I just
found out one day. Well, we're going to go ahead and continue our reading. Our readers may remember that this chapter is all about Kuzma Samsonov, who is an old man. He's Grushenka's patron, which we believe means that he pays her for things.
Services.
Yes, not for goods, but for services. And we also learned that he is so old and gross that his legs are all swollen up, and he has to have one of his big, strong sons carry him around.
Like
the bullet. So we're going to go ahead and start reading where we left off last week. Bryson, you can go ahead and start now.
May suppose he felt a certain rather strong curiosity. This drawing room, where Mitya was waiting, was a huge, dreary, killingly depressing room, with windows on both sides, a gallery, marbled walls, and three huge crystal chandeliers in dust covers. Mitya was sitting in a little chair by the entrance, awaiting his fate with nervous impatience. When the old man appeared at the opposite door, about 20 yards away from Mitya's chair, he jumped up suddenly and went to meet him with his long, firm military stride. Mitya was respectably dressed, but buttoned in a buttoned frock coat, was holding a round hat and wearing black leather gloves, exactly as 3 days before in the monastery at the elders, at the family meeting with Fyodor Pavlovich and his brothers. The old man stood solemnly and sternly waiting for him, and Mitya felt at once that he was examining him thoroughly as he approached. Mitya was also struck by the face of Kuzma Kuzmich, which had become extremely swollen recently. His lower lip, which had always been thick, now looked like the kind of drooping pancake.
Gross.
That is disgusting. He bowed solemnly and silently to his guest, motioned him to an armchair near the sofa, and leaning on his son's arm with painful groans, began slowly lowering himself onto the sofa facing Mitya, who, seeing his painful expressions, immediately felt remorse in his heart, sensible of his present insignificance before this so solemn personage whom he had ventured to disturb.
What do you want of me, sir?
The old man, having finally seated himself, said slowly, distinctly, sternly, but courteously.
Mitya gave a start, jumped up, and sat down again. Then, all at once, he began speaking loudly, quickly, nervously, gesticulating, and decidedly in a frenzy. Here, obviously, was a man at the end of his rope, facing ruin and looking for a last way out. And if he did not find it, he must just go and drown himself. All this old Samsonov probably understood instantly, through his face, remained unchanged, and cold as an idol's.
The most honorable Kuzma Kuzmich has doubtless already heard more than once of my disputes with my father, Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, who robbed me of my inheritance after my own mother, because the whole town is chattering about it, because here everyone chatters about things they shouldn't. And besides, it might also have come to you from Grushinka, I beg your pardon, from Agrafena Alexandrovna. From Agrafena Alexandrovna, who is so greatly respected and so greatly honored by me. Thus Mitya began, and broke off at the first sentence. However, we will not quote his whole speech word for word, but will only give a summary of it. The thing was, he said, that 3 months ago he, Mitya, had purposefully consulted, he precisely said purposefully, not purposely, a lawyer in the provincial capital, a famous lawyer, Kuzma Kuzmich, Pavel Pavlovich Korneplodov, oh, this is a quote. A famous lawyer, Kuzma Kuzmich, Pavel Pavlovich Korneplodov. Perhaps you've heard of him, sir. So. The way that we've been doing the redo rule has been debated fiercely over the weeks. And we will leave it up to you to interpret as you will.
Okay.
But if you break my interpretation, then I don't make the rules, I only enforce them.
Okay, yeah.
So.
That's fair.
Okay. Perhaps you've heard of him, sir. A vast brain, almost the mind of a statesman. He knows you too. He has the highest opinion. Mitya broke off again, but these gaps did not deter Mitya. He immediately leaped over them and rushed ahead. This time, Korneplodov, after questioning him in detail and examining all the documents Mitya could present to him, about the documents Mitya spoke vaguely, and became particularly hurried at this point. Opined that with regard to the village of Chermashnia, which should, he said, belong to him, Mitya, from his mother, it would indeed be possible to start a court action and knock the pins out from under the old hooligan. Because it's impossible that all doors are locked, and the law knows all the loopholes. In a word, he might hope for as much as an additional 6,000 from Fyodor Pavlovich, maybe even 7, because after all, Chermashnia is worth not less than 25,000, that is, certainly 28. 30, in fact, 30, Kuzma Kuzmich. And just imagine, I never even got 17 out of that cruel man. And then, he said, I, Mitya, dropped the whole business because I can't deal with the law, and when I came here, I was dumbstruck by a countersuit. Here Mitya became confused again and again leaped abruptly ahead. And so, most honorable Kuzma Kuzmich, he said, how would you like to take over all my claims against that monster and give me just 3,000? You can't lose in any case, I swear it on my honor, and quite the opposite. You could make 6 or 7,000 instead of 3. And above all, it must be settled this same day. I'll, at the notary, is it, or whatever. In a word, I'm ready for anything. I'll supply all the documents you want, I'll sign anything. And we could drop the papers right now, and if possible, if only it were possible, this morning, you could let me have the 3,000, because who else is a capitalist in this little town if not you? And you would save me from, in a word, you would save my poor head for a most honorable deed, for a most lofty deed, one might say. For I cherish the most honorable feelings for a certain person, whom you know only too well, sir, and for whom you have a fatherly concern. Otherwise I wouldn't have come if it weren't fatherly. And here three men are at loggerheads, if you like, because fate is a grisly thing. Kuzma Kuzmich. Realism, Kuzma Kuzmich, realism! And since you should have been counted out long ago, there are two heads left, as I put it, awkwardly perhaps, but I'm not a literary man. That is, one of the heads is mine, and the other, that monster's. So choose, me or the monster. Everything is in your hands now. Three fates and two lots. Forgive me, I've gotten confused, but you understand. I can see by your venerable eyes that you understand. And if you don't understand, I'll drown myself today. That's it!
Mitya broke off his absurd speech with, "That's it!" and jumping up from his seat, awaited the answer to his stupid offer. At the last phrase, he felt suddenly and hopelessly that everything had fallen through, and above all, that he had produced a lot of terrible dribble.
Accurate.
Strange. On my way here, it all seemed fine, and now it's all dribble. Suddenly flashed through his hopeless head. All the while he was talking, the old man sat motionlessly and watched him with an icy expression in his eyes. However, after keeping him in suspense for a moment, Kuzma Kuzmich at last declared, in the most resolute and cheerless tone,
Excuse me, sir. We do not engage in that kind of business.
Mitya suddenly felt his legs give way under him.
What am I to do now, Kuzma Kuzmich? He murmured with a pale smile. I'm done for, don't you think?
Excuse me, sir.
Mitya went on standing, staring fixedly at the old man, and suddenly noticed a slight movement in his face. He gave a start.
You see, sir, such business is not our line. The old man's...
You see, sir, such business is not our line,
the old man said slowly.
There would be courts, lawyers, all kinds of trouble. But there is a man for that, if you like. You can try him.
My God, who is he? You are my resurrection, Kuzma Kuzmich, Mitya began babbling suddenly.
He's not a local man, the one I mean. And he's not here now. He's from peasants. He trades in timber. He's called Laigava. He's been bargaining for a year with Fyodor Pavlovich over that woodlot in Germania. But they can't agree on the price, as perhaps you've heard. Now he's come back again and is staying with the priest in Ilskoye, about 8 miles or so from Volovia Station in the village of Ilyinskoye. He also wrote here to me about the same business, that is, concerning the woodlot, asking my advice. Fyodor Pavlovich himself wants to go and see him. So, if you were to get there ahead of Fyodor Pavlovich and make Laigavi the same offer you made me, he might just...
A brilliant idea, Mitya interrupted ecstatically. It's made for him, just made for him. He's bargaining, the price is too high, and here is this document of ownership, just made for him. Ha ha ha!
Mitya burst into his clipped wooden laugh so unexpectedly that even Samsonov jerked his head.
How can I thank you, Kuzma Kuzmich? Mitya was bubbling over.
It's nothing, sir.
Samsonov inclined his head.
But you don't realize. You've saved me. Oh, I was drowned. I was drawn to you by some presentiment. And so off to that priest.
No thanks are necessary, sir.
I hasten, I fly, I've abused your help. I will remember it always. It's a Russian man saying it to you, Kuzma Kuzmich, a Russian man.
Well, sir.
Mitya seized his hand to shake it, but something malicious flashed in the old man's eyes. Mitya drew back his hand and at once reproached himself for his suspicion. He must be tired, flashed through his mind.
For her! For her, Kuzma Kuzmich, you understand, it's for her,
he roared suddenly to the rafters, then bowed, turned around sharply, and with the same long, quick strides, walked to the door without looking back. He was trembling with delight.
Everything was on the verge of ruin, and my guardian angel saved me, raced through his mind. And if such a businessman as this old man, a most honorable old man, and what bearing, has pointed out this course, then this course must surely be a winner. I'll fly immediately. I'll be back before nightfall. By nightfall. But the thing will be won. Can the old man have been laughing at me?
Thus Mitya exclaimed, striding back to his lodgings, and of course, to his mind, it could not have appeared otherwise. That is, either it was business-like advice and from such a businessman who knows business and knows this Liagavi, strange name, or the old man was laughing at him. Alas, only the second of these thoughts was true. Later, much later, when the whole catastrophe had already taken place, old Samsonov himself admitted, laughing, that he had made a fool of the
captain.
This was a spiteful, cold, and sarcastic man, full of morbid antipathies as well. Whether it was the rapturous look of the captain, the foolish conviction of this
wastrel and spindrift,
that he, Samsonov, might fall for something as wild as his plan, or jealousy over Grushenka, in whose name this
madcap
came with such a wild thing, asking for money. I cannot say what precisely prompted the old man at the time, but when Mitya stood before him, feeling his legs give way, and exclaimed senselessly that he was done for, at that moment the old man looked upon him with boundless spite and decided to make a fool of him. Once Mitya had left, Kuzma Kuzmich, livid with spite, turned to his son and told him to give orders that not a hair of that ragamuffin was to be seen in the future, that he was not even allowed into the yard, or else.
He did not finish his threat, but even his son, who had often seen him angry, jumped in fear. For a whole hour afterwards, the old man was even shaking all over with spite. And by evening, he had fallen ill and sent for a leech.
There's so much sudden and dramatic and sometimes incomprehensible emotion that happens in this book. Like, someone will be sitting there and then all of a sudden it's like, and then out of nowhere, he was so angry that he stomped on his hat, or like, Kuzma suddenly, though annoyed with Dimitri, decides that he hates him. just all up at once.
No reason.
Chapter 2. The Agaby. So he had to go at a gallop, and yet he had no money, not a kopeck for horses. That is, he had 40 kopecks, but that was all that remained from so many years of former prosperity. But at home, he had an old silver watch that he had long since stopped, running. He grabbed it and took it to a watchmaker, a Jew, who had his shop in the marketplace. The Jew gave him 6 rubles for it. I didn't expect even that much, cried the delighted Mitya. He still went on being delighted, grabbed his 6 rubles, and ran home. At home, he added to the sum, borrowing 3 rubles from his landlords, who gave it to him gladly, though it was their last money. So much did they love him. Mitya, in his rapturous state, revealed to them at once that his fate was being decided, and told them, in a terrible hurry, of course, almost the whole of his plan, which he had just presented to Samsonov, then Samsonov's decision, his future hopes, and so on and so forth. His landlords, even before then, had been initiated into many of his secrets, which was why they looked upon him as one of their own, not at all as a proud gentleman. Having thus collected 9 rubles, Mitya sent for a post-horse going to Volovia station. But in this way, the fact came to be remembered and noted that,
on the eve of a certain event, at noon, Mitya did not have a kopeck, and that, in order to get money, he sold his watch and borrowed 3 rubles from his landlords, all in the presence of witnesses.
I noted this fact beforehand. Why I do so will become clear later.
Foreshadowing.
That's,
yeah. Does that even count as foreshadowing?
I don't even think you're allowed to say
it. If you say,
this is really, important. I'm not going to tell you about it now. It's going to come up
Trust
later,
me.
Though. This is really important. Don't forget it.
Trust me. That A on her shirt is going to mean something later in the book.
Or in your case, that Mockingjay pin.
Yes.
This is really important. I'm going to give it to you. It probably won't mean anything.
For right now.
I just need
wear it.
Just hang on for a second.
Next few years from now. People will think this is a big deal. I note this fact beforehand.
Cool, this isn't cool now. It's going to be cool later.
I've been saying that about Brothers Karamazov and Friends for months now.
Guys,
it's not very cool yet, but it's about to be
It's gonna get really awesome. I know there's just this first half of the book is foreshadowing. Right here, this is the turning point.
When they tell you that it's been foreshadowing, we're catching up.
We're there. It's about to get, I'm dying to just start reading the rest of this.
Although, as he galloped to Volovia station, Mitya was beaming with joyful anticipation that he was at least about to finish and have done with all these affairs. He was nevertheless also trembling with fear. What would happen with Grushenka now in his absence? What if precisely today she should at last decide to go to Fyodor Pavlovich? That was why he left without telling her and ordered his landlords under no circumstances to reveal where he was going if anyone should come asking for him. I must get back by this evening, he kept saying as he jolted along in the wagon, and maybe even drag this Leagavi here to execute this deed. So Mitya dreamed with a sinking soul, but alas, his dreams were not at all destined to come true according to his plan.
First of all, he was late, having set out on a back road from a Volovia station. Instead of 8 miles, it turned out to be 12. Second, he did not find the Ilinskoye priest at home. He was away in a neighboring village. It was almost dark by the time Mitya located him, having driven to his neighboring village with the same already exhausted horses. Smart move. The priest, a timid, tender-looking little man, explained to him at once that though this Liagyava had been staying with him at first, he was now in Sukhoi Posyolok, and would be spending the night in the forester's hut, because he was buying timber there too. To Mitya's urgent request to take him to Lyagiva at once, and thereby to save him, so to speak, the priest, though hesitant at first, finally agreed to go with him to Sukhoi Posyolok, apparently out of curiosity. But, as bad luck would have it, he suggested that they go afoot, since it was only a wee bit more than half a mile. Mitya naturally agreed, and set off with his long strides, so that the poor priest almost had to run to keep up. He was not yet old, and was a very cautious little man. Mitya also began speaking with him at once about his plans, hotly and nervously demanding advice concerning Lyagiva, and talked all the way. The priest listened attentively, but gave little advice. He responded evasively to Mitya's questions.
I don't know. Oh, I don't know. How am I to know that?
And so on. When Mitya began speaking about his disputes with his father over the inheritance, the priest was even frightened, because he stood in some sort of dependent relation to Fyodor Pavlovich. However, he did ask in surprise why Mitya called this peasant trader Gorstkin by the name of Lyagiva, and made a point of explaining to him that though the man was indeed Lyagiva, he was also not Lyagiva, because he took bitter offense at the name, and that he must be called Gorstkin.
Otherwise, you won't get anywhere with him, and he won't even listen, the priest concluded.
I'm glad that the guy hates being called Lyagiva, but does not mind being called Gorstkin.
Yeah, that's... a much better choice. Much better.
Call me Gorskin!
Oh, no. Lyagiva, that is too formal. I do not like it.
Mitya was slightly and briefly surprised, and explained that Samsonov himself had referred to the man that way. On hearing of this circumstance, the priest at once changed the subject, though he would have done better to explain then and there to Dmitri Fyodorovich what he suspected, that if Samsonov himself had sent him to this peasant calling him Lyagiva, did he not do it in mockery for some reason, and wasn't there something wrong here? But Mitya had no time to pause over such trifles. He rushed, he strode along, and only when they reached Sukhoi Posyolok did he realize that they had gone not half a mile, not a mile, but a good mile and a half. This annoyed him, but he let it pass. They went into the hut. The forester, an acquaintance of the priest, occupied half of the hut, and in the other half, the good half, to the opposite side of the entryway, Gorstkin was staying. They went into this good room and lighted a tallow candle. The room was overheated. The samovar on the pine table had gone out. There were also a tray with cups, an empty bottle of rum, and an almost empty quart bottle of vodka, and some crusts of white bread. The visitor himself lay stretched out on a bench, his coat bunched up under his head for a pillow, snoring heavily. Mitya stood perplexed.
Of course I must wake him. My business is too important. I've hurried so. I'm in a hurry to get back today.
Mitya became alarmed. But the priest and the forester stood silently without expressing their opinion. Mitya went over himself and began shaking him quite energetically. But the sleeping man would not wake up.
He's drunk, Mitya decided. But what am I to do, Lord? What am I to do?
And suddenly, in terrible impatience, he began tugging the sleeping man by the arms and legs, rolling his head back and forth, lifting him up and sitting him on the bench. Yet after prolonged exertions, all he accomplished was that the man began mumbling absurdly and uttering strong but inarticulate oaths.
Dmitri and Gorstkin get involved in a classic game of limp limbs, which we've all played.
We've all played.
No, you'd better wait, the priest finally announced. He's obviously in no condition.
Been drinking all day, the forester echoed.
Oh, God! Mitya kept exclaiming. If only you knew how necessary it is, and what despair I'm in now.
No, you'd better wait till morning, the priest repeated.
Till morning? But merciful God, that's impossible!
And in his despair, he was about to rush at the drunk man to wake him, but stopped at once, realizing that all efforts were useless. The priest was silent, the sleepy forester was gloomy.
What terrible tragedies realism inflicts on people! Yes, realism.
Mitya stops to make a poignant remark about realism.
What? Mitya uttered in complete despair. Sweat was streaming down his face. Seizing the moment, the priest quite reasonably explained that even if they succeeded in waking the sleeping man up, still, in his drunken state, he would not be fit for any conversation. And you have important business, so it would be safer to leave it till morning. Mitya spread his arms helplessly and agreed, deciding to play Flint Society.
I'll stay here, Father, with a lighted candle, and try to catch the right moment. When he wakes up, I'll pay you for the candle.
He turned to the forester, and for the night's lodging, too.
You'll remember Dmitri Karamazov. Only I don't know what to do with you, Father. Where will you sleep?
No, I'd better go back to my place, sir. I'll take his mare and go.
He pointed to the forester. Oh, God. I'm gonna take your horse.
I'll just take
you don't have
horse.
A choice. And now, farewell, sir. I hope you get full satisfaction.
So it was settled. The priest rode off on the mare, happy to have escaped at last, but still shaking his head in perplexity and wondering whether first thing next day he ought to inform his benefactor, Fyodor Pavlovich, of this curious incident.
Or else, worse luck, he may find out to get angry and stop his favors.
The forester, having scratched himself, silently went back to his room, and Mitya sat on the bench waiting, as he put it, to catch the right moment. Deep anguish, like a heavy fog, enveloped his soul. Deep, terrible anguish. He sat and thought, but could not think anything through. The candle flickered, a cricket chirped. It was becoming unbearably stuffy in the overheated room. He suddenly imagined a garden, a lane behind the garden, the door of his father's house secretly opening, and Grushenka running in through the door. He jumped up from the bench.
A tragedy, he said, grinding his teeth. And mechanically going over to the sleeping man, he began looking at his face. He was a lean man, not yet old, with a very oblong face, light brown curly hair, and a long, thin, reddish beard, wearing a cotton shirt and a black waistcoat, from the pocket of which the chain of a silver watch peeped out. Mitya examined his physiognomy with terrible hatred, and for some reason, the most hateful thing was his curly hair.
Obviously.
No.
I shouldn't say, and for some reason, I should say, and for some... And obviously, the most hateful thing.
His damn curly hair. Above all, it was unbearably vexing that he, Mitya, should be standing there over him with his urgent business, having sacrificed so much, having left so much behind, utterly exhausted, while this parasite, on whom my entire fate now depends, goes on snoring as if nothing were wrong, as if he came from another planet. He's an alien. Oh, the irony of fate!
Mitya again stops to make a poignant remark.
Mitya exclaimed, and suddenly, losing his head altogether, he again tried frantically to rouse the drunken peasant. He began rousing him in a kind of rage, pulled him, pushed him, even beat him. But, having labored over him for about 5 minutes, again with no results, went back to his bench in helpless despair and sat down. He labored for 5 minutes. Only, yes.
Stupid! Stupid! Mitya kept exclaiming. And how dishonorable it all is,
he suddenly added for some reason. He was getting a terrible headache.
Why not drop it? Go away altogether, flashed through his mind. Oh no, not before morning. On purpose. I'll stay on purpose. Why did I come, after all? And I have no means of leaving. How can I leave here now? Oh, absurd!
His head, however, was aching more and more. He sat without moving, and had no recollection of how he dozed off, and suddenly fell asleep sitting up. He must have slept for 2 hours or more. It turns out not only do they have emotions that immediately overtake them, but also states of consciousness.
Yes.
immediately fell asleep sitting up. He was awakened by an unbearable pain in his head, so unbearable he could have screamed. It hammered at his temples, the top of his head throbbed. Having come to, it was a long time before he was able to regain full consciousness and understand what had happened to him. He finally realized that the overheated room was full of fumes and that he might have died, and the drunken peasant still lay there and snored. The candle guttered and was about to go out. Mitya shouted and rushed staggering across the hallway to the forester's room. The forester woke up quickly, but on hearing that the other room was full of fumes, though he went to take care of it, he accepted the fact with strange indifference, which sorely surprised Mitya.
"But he's dead! He's dead! And now, what now?" Mitya kept shouting before him in a frenzy.
They opened the door, flung the windows wide, undamped the flue. Mitya brought a bucket of water from the hallway, wet his own head first, and then, finding some rag, dipped it in the water and put it to Yagyuva's head. The forester continued to treat the whole event somehow, even disdainfully, and after opening the window, said sullenly, "That'll do." And went, yes. Open the window, and that's gonna do it. And went back to bed, leaving Mitya with a lighted iron lantern. So, you know, more fumes. Mitya fussed over the fume-poisoned drunkard for about half an hour, kept wetting his head, and seriously intended not to sleep for the rest of the night. But he became exhausted, sat down for a moment to catch his breath, instantly closed his eyes, then unconsciously stretched out on the bench and fell asleep at once, or fell at once into a dead sleep.
He woke up terribly late. It was already approximately 9 o'clock in the morning. The sun was shining brightly through the two windows of the hut. The curly-headed peasant of the night before was sitting on a bench, already dressed in his long-waisted coat. Before him stood a fresh samovar and a fresh quart bottle. The old one from the day before was empty, and the new one was more than half gone. Mitya jumped up and instantly realized that the cursed peasant was drunk again, deeply and irretrievably drunk. He stared wide-eyed at him for a moment. The peasant kept glancing at him silently and slyly, with a sort of offensive composure, even with a sort of derisive haughtiness, as Mitya fancied. He rushed up to him.
"Allow me, you see, you've probably heard from the forester there in the other room. I am Lieutenant Dmitri Karamazov, old Karamazov's son, from whom you are buying a woodlot."
This is the time.
This is a new character.
Yeah, you gotta really get prepared for this.
I've been waiting for this moment, actually. I'm happy it landed on you, because I don't have any idea.
"That's a lie!"
The peasant suddenly rapped out firmly and calmly.
"A lie? If you please. You do not know Fyodor Pavlovich?"
"I don't please to know any Fyodor Pavlovich of yours," the peasant said, moving his tongue somehow heavily.
"A woodlot. You're buying a woodlot from him. Wake up. Come to your senses. Father Pavel Ilinsky brought me here. You wrote to Samsonov, and he sent me to you," Mitya spoke breathlessly.
"A lie!"
Lyagavy again rapped out.
Mitya's legs went cold.
"For pity's sake, this isn't a joke. You're a bit drunk, perhaps, but anyway, you can speak, you can understand. Otherwise, I don't understand anything."
"You're a dyer!"
"For pity's sake, I'm Karamazov, Dmitri Karamazov. I have an offer to make you. A profitable offer. Quite profitable. About that same woodlot."
The peasant was stroking his beard solemnly.
"No, you contracted for the job and turned out to be a cheat. You're a cheat."
"You're mistaken, I assure you." Mitya was wringing his hands in despair. The peasant kept stroking his beard and suddenly narrowed his eyes slyly.
"No, you show me one thing. Show me where there's a law that allows people to play dirty tricks. Do you hear? You're a cheat. Understand?"
Mitya glumly stepped back, and suddenly it was as though something hit him on the head. As he himself put it later, in an instant, a sort of illumination came to him. A light shone, and I perceived everything. He stood dumbfounded, wondering how he, an intelligent man after all, could have given in to such foolishness, could have been sucked into such an adventure, and kept on with it all for nearly a whole day and night, worrying over this Lyagyovy, wetting his head. Well, the man is drunk. Drunk out of his mind. And he'll go on drinking for another week. What is there to wait for? And what if Samsonov sent me here on purpose? And what if she... Oh, God, what have I done?
The peasant sat watching him and chuckled. On another occasion, Mitya might have killed the fool in a rage. But now he himself became weak as a child. He quietly walked over to the bench, took his coat, silently put it on, and went out of the room. He did not find the forester in the other room. No one was there. He took 50 kopecks in change from his pocket and put it on the table for the night's lodging, the candle, and the trouble. Stepping out of the hut, he saw nothing but forest all around. He walked at random, not even remembering whether to turn right or left from the hut. Hurrying there with the priest the night before, he had not noticed the way. There was no vengeance in his soul for anyone, not even Samsonov. He strolled along a narrow forest path, senselessly lost with his lost idea, not caring where he was going. A passing child might have knocked him down, so strengthless had he suddenly become in soul and body. Somehow, he nevertheless got out of the forest. Suddenly, before him spread a boundless expanse of bare, harvested fields. "What despair! What death all around!" he kept saying as he strode on and on.
He was saved by some passers-by. A coachman was taking an old merchant over the back road. When they drew up with him, Mitya asked the way, and it turned out that they, too, were going to Volovya. After some negotiating, they agreed to take Mitya along. They arrived after 3 hours. At Volovya station, Mitya immediately ordered post horses to town, and suddenly realized that he was impossibly hungry. Impossibly hungry.
So hungry, it wasn't possible to be that hungry.
It was not possible. Suddenly, he was impossible. While the horses were being harnessed, some fried eggs were fixed for him. He ate them instantly at a whole big, ate a whole big hunk of bread, ate some sausage that turned up, and drank 3 glasses of vodka.
Perfect breakfast.
Breakfast of champions. Having refreshed himself, he cheered up, and his soul brightened again. Well, of course, he had 3 glasses of vodka. He flew down the road, urging the coachman on, and suddenly arrived at a new, and this time, immutable plan for obtaining that accursed money before evening. And to think that a man's fate should be ruined because of a worthless 3,000 rubles, he exclaimed contemptuously, "I'll have done it today!" And had it not been for ceaselessly thinking of Grushenka, and whether anything had happened with her, he would perhaps have become quite happy again. But the thought of her stabbed his soul every moment like a sharp knife. They arrived at last, and Mitya ran at once to Grushenka.
Chapter 3. Gold Mines. This was precisely the visit from Mitya of which Grushenka had told Rakitin with such fear. She was then expecting her messenger, and was very glad that Mitya had not come either the day before or that day, hoping that perchance, God willing, he would not come before her departure, when suddenly he descended upon her. The rest we know. In order to get him off her hands, she persuaded him at once to take her to Kuzma Samsonov's, where she said it was terribly necessary for her to go to count the money. And when Mitya promptly took her, she made him promise, even as she said goodbye to him at Kuzma's gate, to come for her after 11 and take her home again. Mitya was also pleased with this order. "If she's sitting at Kuzma's, she won't go to Fyodor Pavlovich. If only she's not lying," he added at once. But from what he could see, she was not lying. His jealousy was precisely of such a sort that, separated from the beloved woman, he had once invented all kinds of horrors about what was happening with her, and how she had gone and betrayed him. But running back to her, shaken, crushed, convinced irretrievably that she had managed to betray him, with a first look at her face, at the gay, laughing, tender face of this woman, his spirits would at once revive, he would at once lose all suspicion, and with joyful shame reproach himself for his jealousy. Having approached Grushenka, he rushed home. Oh, he still somehow had to do so much that day, but at least he felt relieved. "Only I must find out quickly from Smerdyakov whether anything happened last night, whether, God forbid, she went to Fyodor Pavlovich," raced through his head. And so, in just the time it took him to run home, jealousy had already begun stirring in his restless heart.
Jealousy! Othello is not jealous. He is trustful, Pushkin observed. And this one observation already testifies to the remarkable depth of our great poet's mind. Othello's soul is simply shattered and his whole worldview clouded because his ideal is destroyed. Othello will not hide, spy, peep. He is trustful. On the contrary, he had to be led, prompted, roused, with great effort to make him even think of betrayal. A truly jealous man is not like that. It is impossible to imagine all the shame and moral degradation a jealous man can tolerate without the least remorse. And it is not that they are all trite and dirty souls. On the contrary, it is possible to have a lofty heart, to love purely, to be full of self-sacrifice, and at the same time to hide under tables, to bribe the meanest people, and live with the nastiest filth of spying and eavesdropping.
I don't know if I completely agree with that.
It's okay. You can be a great person and do some terrible, terrible things and be with some terrible people, but you can still be a great person. Just don't know if you can. Othello could in no way be reconciled with betrayal. Not that he could not forgive, but he could not be reconciled. Though his soul was gentle and innocent as a babe's. Not so the truly jealous man. It is hard to imagine what some jealous men can tolerate and be reconciled to, and what they can forgive. Jealous men forgive sooner than anyone else, and all women know it. The jealous man, having first made a terrible scene, of course, can and will very promptly forgive, for example, a nearly proven betrayal. The embraces and kisses he has seen himself if, for example, at the same time he can somehow be convinced that this was the last time, and that his rival will disappear from that moment on, that he will go to the end of the earth, or that he himself will take her away somewhere, to some place where this terrible rival will never come. Of course, the reconciliation will only last an hour, because even if the rival has indeed disappeared, tomorrow he will invent another, a new one, and become jealous of this new one. And one may ask, what is the good of a love that must constantly be spied on? And what is the worth of a love that needs to be guarded so intensely? But that is something the truly jealous will never understand. Though at the same time there happen indeed to be lofty hearts among them. It is also remarkable that these same lofty-hearted men, while standing in some sort of closet, eavesdropping and spying, though they understand clearly, in their lofty hearts, all the shame they have gotten into of their own will, nevertheless, at least for that moment, while standing in that closet, will not feel any pangs of remorse. Mitya's jealousy disappeared at the sight of Grushenka, and for a moment he became trustful and noble, and even despised himself for his bad feelings. But this meant only that his love for the woman consisted in something much higher than he himself supposed, and not in passion alone, not merely in that curve of the body he had explained to Alyosha. But when Grushenka disappeared, Mitya at once began again to suspect her in all the baseness and perfidy of betrayal. And for that, he felt no pangs of remorse.
What a long discussion of the nature of jealousy.
That is. And who better than the example of Othello?
The good news is that, Dostoevsky just went right for the thesis statement on that paragraph.
Yeah.
Jealousy!
Immediate.
And so jealousy was again seething in him. He had to hurry in any case. First of all, he needed at least a little money to get by on. The previous day's 9 rubles had been almost entirely spent on the trip, and without money, as everyone knows, one cannot take a step. But that morning in the wagon, along with his new plan, he had also thought of how to find some money to get by on. He had a pair of fine dueling pistols with cartridges, and if he had not pawned them yet, it was because he loved them more than anything else he owned. Sometime before, in the metropolis, he had struck up a slight acquaintance with a certain young official and had learned somehow, also in the tavern, that this official, a bachelor of no small means, had a passion for weapons, bought pistols, revolvers, daggers, hung them on the wall, showed them to his acquaintances, boasted of them, was expert at explaining the workings of the revolver,
LeVar. Revolver.
Workings of the revolver, loading, firing, and so on. Without thinking twice, Mickey went straight to him and offered to pawn the pistols to him for 10 rubles. The delighted official tried to persuade him to sell them outright, but Mickey would not agree, so the man handed him 10 rubles, declaring that he would not think of accepting any interest. They parted friends. Mickey was in a hurry. He raced off to behind Fyodor Pavlovich's, to his gazebo, in order to send quickly for Smerdyakov. In this way, again, the fact emerged that only 3 or 4 hours before a certain incident, of which I shall speak below, Mitya did not have a kopeck, and pawned his dearest possession for 10 rubles, whereas 3 hours later he suddenly had thousands in his hands. But I anticipate.
Foreshadowing. Don't get ahead of yourself.
Psst. This part's important.
He's gonna have lots of money. Oh! I didn't mean to say that. At Maria Kondrietievna's, next door to Fyodor Pavlovich, the news awaited him of Smerdyakov's illness, which struck and dismayed him greatly. He listened to the story of the fall into the cellar, then of the falling fit, the doctor's visit, Fyodor Pavlovich's concern. He was also interested to learn that his brother, Ivan Fyodorovich, had gone off to Moscow that morning. He must have passed through Volovya ahead of me, Dmitri Fyodorovich thought, but Smerdyakov troubled him terribly. What now? Who will keep watch? Who will bring me word? Greedily he began inquiring of the women whether they had noticed anything the previous evening. They knew very well what he was trying to find out and reassured him completely. No one had come. Ivan Fyodorovich had spent the night there. Everything was in perfect order, Mitya began to think. Undoubtedly, he had to be on watch today, too. But where, here, or at Samsonov's gate? Both here and there, he decided, depending on the situation. But meanwhile, what faced him now was that morning's plan. The new, and this time certain plan, which he had thought up in the wagon. The carrying out of which could not be put off any longer. Mitya decided to sacrifice an hour to it. In an hour, I'll settle everything, find out everything, and then, first of all, to Samsonov's house, to see whether Grushenka is there. Then, immediately back here till 11. Then, again, to Samsonov's, to take her home. That was what he decided.
A marvelous plan. He flew home, washed, combed his hair, brushed his clothes, got dressed, and went to see Madame Koklikov. Alas, his plan lay there. He had made up his mind to borrow the 3,000 from this lady. Moreover, suddenly, somehow unexpectedly, he had acquired a remarkable certainty that she would not refuse him. It may be wondered why, given such certainty, he had not gone there first, to his own society, so to speak, but had gone instead to Samsonov, a man of alien caste, with whom he did not even know how to speak. But the thing was that for the past month he had almost broken off relations with Madame Koklikov, and even before then had only been slightly acquainted with her. And moreover, he knew very well that she could not stand him. It is a wonder that he didn't go there right away. The lady had detested him from the beginning, simply because he was Katerina Ivanovna's fiancé, whereas she, for some reason, suddenly wanted Katerina Ivanovna to drop him and marry the dear, chivalrously educated Ivan Fyodorovich, who has such beautiful manners. Mitya's manners she detested. Mitya even laughed at her and had said of her once that this lady is as bold and lively as she is uneducated. And so that morning, in the wagon, he had been illumined by a most brilliant idea. If she is so much against my marrying Katerina Ivanovna, and against it to such a degree, he knew it was almost to the point of hysterics, then why should she deny me the 3,000 now, when this money would precisely enable me to leave Katya and clear out of here forever? These spoiled high-up ladies, if they take it into their hands to want something, will spare nothing to get their way. Besides, she's so rich, Mitya reasoned. As for the plan itself, it was all the same as before, that is, the offer of his rights to Chermashnya, but now with no commercial purpose. As with Samsonov the day before, not trying to tempt this lady like Samsonov the day before, with the prospect of picking up twice the sum, about 6 or 7,000, but merely as an honorable pledge for the borrowed money. Mitya went into ecstatics developing his new idea, but that is what always happened to him in all his undertakings. All his sudden decisions. He gave himself passionately to every new idea. Nevertheless, as he stepped onto the porch of Madame Koklikov's house, he suddenly felt a chill of horror run down his spine. Only at that second did he realize fully and now with mathematical clarity that this was his last hope. That if this should fall through, there was nothing left in the world but to kill and rob someone for the 3,000, and that's all. It was 7:30 when he rang the bell.
At first, things seemed to smile on him. He was received at once, with remarkable promptness, as soon as he was announced. Just as if she were expecting me, flashed through Mitya's mind, and then suddenly, as soon as he was shown into the drawing room, the hostess all but ran in and declared directly that she had been expecting him.
I was expecting you! Expecting you! I could not even think you would come to me, you must agree, and yet I was expecting you! Just marvel at my instinct, Dmitri Fyodorovitch! All morning, I felt certain you would come today!
That is indeed amazing, madame, Mitya uttered, sitting down clumsily. But I've come on extremely important business, the most important business for me, that is, madame, for me alone, and I am in a hurry.
I know you have the most important business, Dmitri Fyodorovitch. Here there's no question of presentiments, no retrograde pretense to miracles. Have you not heard about the Elder Zosima? This is mathematics. You could not fail to come after all that's happened with Katerina Ivanovna. You could not. You simply could not. It's mathematics.
The realism of actual life, madame. That's what it is. Allow me, however, to explain.
Realism precisely, Dmitri Fyodorovitch. I'm all for realism now. I've been taught a good lesson about miracles. Have you heard that Zosima died?
No, madame. This is the first I've heard of it. Mitya was a little surprised. Alyosha's image flashed through his mind.
Last night, and just imagine...
Madame, Mitya interrupted, I can imagine that I am in a most desperate position, and that if you do not help me, everything will fall through, and I will fall through first of all. Forgive the triviality of the expression, but I feel hot. I am in a fever.
I know you're in a fever. I know everything, and you could hardly be in any other state of spirit. And whatever you may say, I know everything beforehand. I took your fate into consideration long ago, Dmitri Fyodorovitch. I've been following it, studying it. Oh, believe me, I'm an experienced doctor of souls, Dmitri Fyodorovitch.
Madame, if you are an experienced doctor, I am an experienced patient, Mitya forced himself into pleasantry, and I have a feeling that if you have been following my fate as you say, you will help it in its ruination. But for that, allow me, finally, to explain the plan with which I ventured to come, and what I expect from you. I've come, madame.
Don't explain, it's secondary. As for helping, you will not be the first I've helped, Dmitri Fyodorovitch. You've probably heard about my cousin, Madame Belmisov. Her husband was ruined. He fell through. As you so characteristically expressed, Dmitri Fyodorovitch. And what did I do? I sent him into horse breeding, and now he's flourishing. Do you have any notion of horse breeding, Dmitri Fyodorovitch?
Not in the slightest, madame. Oh, madame, not in the slightest, Mitya exclaimed in nervous impatience, and even rose from his seat. I only beg you, madame, to listen to me. Allow me just 2 minutes to speak freely, so that I can first of all explain to you everything, the whole project with which I have come. Besides, I am short of time. I'm in a terrible hurry, Mitya shouted hysterically, feeling that she was about to start talking again, and hoping to outshout her. I've come in despair, in the last degree of despair, to ask you to lend me money, 3,000, but to lend it on the surest pledge, madam, on the surest security. Oh, let me explain.
All of that later, later, Madame Koklikov waved her hand at him in turn. And whatever you're going to say, I know it all beforehand. I've already told you that. You are asking for a certain sum. You need 3,000, but I'll give you more, infinitely more. I will save you, Dmitri Fyodorovitch, but you must do as I say.
Mitya reared up from his seat again.
Madame, can you possibly be so kind? He cried with extreme feeling. Oh, Lord, you've saved me. You are saving a man from a violent death, madame, from a bullet. My eternal gratitude.
I will give you more,
infinitely more than 3,000, Madame Kotlikov cried, gazing at Mitya's rapture with a beaming smile.
Infinitely? But I don't need so much. All that's necessary is that fatal 3,000, and I, for my part, am prepared to guarantee the sum to you, with infinite gratitude, and I've come to offer you a plan that...
Enough, Dmitri Fyodorovich! It's said I'm wrong!
I like how Dmitri is confused, thinking that she has literally offered him infinite money.
You get infinite
rules. No. I don't need infinite. I don't need infinity. I just need 3,000.
I just need 3,000. I will give you everything! Madame Kotlikov spoke abruptly, with the virtuous triumph of a benefactress. I've promised you to save you, and I will save you. I will save you as I did the Belmethal. What do you think about gold mines, Dmitri Fyodorovich?
Gold mines, madame? I've never thought anything about them.
But I have thought for you. I've thought and thought about it. I've been watching you for a whole month that with that in mind. I've looked at you hundreds of times as you walked by, saying to myself, here is an enigmatic, energetic man who must go to the mines. I have studied your gait and decided this man will find many mines.
From my gait, madame? Mitya smiled.
And why not from your gait? What? Do you deny that it's not possible to tell man's character from his gait, Dmitri Fyodorovich? Natural science confirms it. Oh, I'm a realist now, Dmitri Fyodorovich. From this day on, after all that story in the monastery, which upset me so, I'm such a complete realist and want to throw myself into practical activity. I'm cured enough, as Turgenev said.
But, madame, this 3,000 that you have so generously promised to lend me...
You will get it, Dmitri Fyodorovich, Madame Kotlikov said at once, cut him short. You may consider it as good as in your pocket, and not 3,000, but 3,000,000, Dmitri Fyodorovich, and in no time, I shall tell you your idea. You will discover mines, make millions, return and become an active figure, and you will stir us too, leading us towards the good. Should everything be left to the Jews? You'll build buildings, start various enterprises. You will help the poor, and they will bless you. This is the age of railroads, Dmitri Fyodorovich. You will become known and indispensable to the Ministry of Finance, which is in such need now. The decline of the paper ruble allows me no sleep, Dmitri Fyodorovich. Few know this side of me.
Madame, Dmitri Fyodorovich again interrupted with a certain uneasy foreboding. Perhaps I will really and truly follow your advice, your sound advice, and go there, perhaps, to these mines. We can talk more about it. I'll come again, even many times. But about these 3,000, which you have so generously... Oh, it would set me free, today, if possible. That is, you see, I don't have any time now, not a moment.
Enough, Dmitri Fyodorovich, enough! Madame Kotlikov interrupted insistently. The question is, you are going to the mines or not? Have you fully decided? Answer mathematically! 2. The answer is 2.
I looked at something and I got lost. Oh, I see. I will go, madame, later. I'll go wherever you like, madame, but now...
Wait, then, cried Madame Kotlikov, and jumping up, she rushed to her magnificent bureau with numerous little drawers and began pulling out one drawer after another, looking for something in a terrible hurry.
The 3,000! Mitya's heart froze. And just like that, without any papers, without any deed. Oh, but how gentlemanly, a splendid woman, if only she weren't so talkative.
Here! Madame Kotlikov cried joyfully, coming back to Mitya. Here is what I was looking for!
It was a tiny silver icon on a string, of the kind sometimes worn around the neck together with a cross.
It's from Kiev, Dmitri Fyodorovich, she continued reverently. From the relics of the great martyr Varvara.
allow me personally to put it around your neck and thereby bless you for a new life and new deeds.
And she indeed put the icon around his neck and began tucking it in. Mitya, in great embarrassment, leaned forward and tried to help her, and finally got the icon past his tie and collar and onto his chest.
Now you can go, madam,
Koklogov uttered, solemnly resuming her seat.
Madame, I am so touched. I don't know how to thank for such kindness, but if you knew how precious time is to me now, that sum which I am so much expecting from your generosity. Oh, madame, since you are so kind, so touchingly generous to me, Mitya suddenly exclaimed inspiredly, allow me to reveal to you what you, however, have long known, that I love a certain person here. I've betrayed Katerina Ivanovna, I mean. Oh, I was inhuman and dishonorable towards her, but here I've come to love another, a woman you perhaps despise, madame, for you already know everything, but whom I absolutely cannot part with. Absolutely, and therefore now this 3,000...
Part with everything, Dmitri Fyodorovich,
Madame Koklogov interrupted him in the most determined tone.
Everything, woman especially. Your goal is the mines, and there is no need to take women there. Later, when you return in wealth and glory, you will find a companion for your heart in the highest society. She will be a modern girl, educated and without prejudices. By then, the women's question, which is just beginning now, will have ripened. A new woman will appear.
Madam, that's not it. Not it. Dmitri Fyodorovich clasped his hands imploringly.
That is it, Dmitri Fyodorovich. That is precisely what you need.
Thank you for joining us on the Brothers Karamazov and Friends. Please join us next time for Killing, Karamazovs, and Kremlins.